All right, welcome back to another episode of Scientifically Simple. Today we're going to be talking about the first law of thermodynamics and finally starting to kind of tie in some of those larger themes into back into academia and showing how they apply and where they get used in industry. Today we're going to be talking about enthalpy, as the text describes. You can't win. Mo?
Thanks, Brandon. I hope our audience would like this clip, especially we are trying to be combining the historical progression of events that led to the conclusion of the first law of thermodynamics, as well as we simplify everything we study today about the first law. So as we have stated in our first clip we launched 6 months ago, titled Science Made Simple, the first law of thermodynamics briefly stated that the total energy in any form, including its condensed form, which is mass, is conserved. The sun started with initial mass and energy, and throughout its life to date has been transferring mass into energy through hydrogen fusion. Living organisms like plants use that energy, which we call sunlight, to produce carbohydrate as energy source for their survival, and oxygen as a byproduct we are breathing. Plants and animals end up being fossilized, turning into hydrocarbons we use to propel our rockets into space, and that's what the first law of thermodynamics is. It's a cycle of energy transformation across space-time. So briefly, our clip today would be concentrating on the history timeline prior the first law was officially stated, and after this we're gonna go through the first law's equation for both closed and open systems, what's a state property versus a path property, and why we have to mathematically identify those two properties, and what does it mean physically. Then we will build up upon what we will build upon that moving forward.
And kind of jumping off that too, I believe that by the time we get to the end of this, you'll kind of see where enthalpy comes to play and how it's used, right? Specifically, taking one form of energy, converting it to another, or using one form of energy to make a desired process happen, right? In essence, this is kind of our currency that we're going to play with, and there's only so much of it to go around.
Absolutely. And that's where we are starting, the historical facts around first law of thermodynamics and how that timeline looks like. So steam powered engine was Deiolipol, described by the hero of Alexandria, who was a great Greek mathematician and engineer in Roman Egypt in the first century AD. And that's pretty much how the device looked like. It's you're having a heat source below a sphere that's filled with water, and pretty much as you heat that water, it turns into steam, and that steam pretty much goes into out of these nozzles and end up having this rotation that you're seeing in that visual. Then a rudimentary steam turbine device was described by a guy in Ottoman Egypt in 1551 called Taqiyuddin, and pretty much the spit is rotated by directing steam into the vanes, which we then turns the wheel at the end of the axle, as you see at the bottom. The funny thing about the picture, it's in a museum, or somehow they connected that device to be making shawarma or doner, so releasing steam to be heating that meat.
Did you say Egypt?
Then in yes.
Egypt, yeah, represent.
So, hero of Alexandria, that was Roman Egypt, and then you have Ottoman Egypt, in 1551, from history perspective regarding steam engines. and why we are going through the Steam Engine as a start. So Thomas Savery is now, like, we are getting into the modern centuries, like, you know, and Thomas Savery is considered the first inventor of first commercially used steam powered device. That steam pump basically was being used to operate directly on the water, to be pumping water out of, you know, of rivers, etc. So after this, now we are moving to James, you know, Newcomen, and that was the first commercially successful engine that could transmit continuous power to a machine, and that was, like, you know, done by Thomas Newcomen in 1712. It was being successfully finally being applied to pump water out of the coal mines in England. That's however really cool. I know, as you can see in that animation, the one problem was that engine was, like, the steam engine and the condenser was one thing. So the engine, the steam, like, you know, expands, and now you are sending water in to be reheated, and it's the same time to cooling. So it's like, you know, it was like a very primitive way, and you know, the efficiency of that machine was like around 0.5%. But again, it's a huge leap. Oof. Like, in terms of, like, you know, trying to be actually getting a useful work out of heat. Now, like, James Watt comes later on and develops this, separates out, like, the condenser away from the engine, and that was basically the critical improvement that he did in 1764. So that was greatly improving the amount of work obtained per unit of the fuel that's being consumed. It was a very famous improvement. It was a very significant improvement, whereby the steam engine got boosted its efficiency from 0.5% almost to around 3%. It was still extremely inefficient, but by far it was way better than all the previous versions. So what do we have out, like, you know, like a takeout from this? There are three common critical takeouts from these devices. Number one, the combustion of fuel as a source of heat energy being harnessed as a way of extracting a useful mechanical work. So that's the statement. We're always, like, fuel is being burned, you know, and there was a lot of trials in order to extract a useful mechanical work out of it. Number two, there wasn't yet, at least as we know of, a physical mathematical formulation to capture the concept of heat energy, mechanical energy, engine efficiency, etc. We just need to develop something to make it work in the first place. Right. The third, number three, which is, like, it's just like, it's a very significant point that we need to highlight in our modern era. The physical intuition that seeking to get an engineering application that has a clear goal came first. Then, as we will highlight in the next slide, that created a clear pathway to have a mathematical structure to further improve the overall system, not the other way around. So, physics, engineering application, how I can use what I have in order to reach a given application that can be useful. Then that cleared the pathway for it to be, like, put together in a mathematical formulation. Now, going into our, you know, the our modern era, we are gonna, of course, start, like, with Sir Isaac Newton. In 1687, Sir Isaac Newton's Principia was published, and it's one of the most important books in natural philosophy, in which he establishes the modern science of dynamics and outlines his three laws of motion. Newton argued that momentum conservation was a crucial principle of mechanics, and he assumed in his work a broad range of problems in mechanics require conservation of energy for their solution, but the concept of energy wasn't well formulated or clearly defined at this stage. On a separate occasion, speaking of the heat energy, Antoine's promoting the chemical revolution, his chemistry was his systematic determinations of weights of reagents and products involved in chemical actions, including the gaseous component, and his underlying belief that matter, identified by the weight, would be conserved through any reaction. And that's how the law of conservation of mass was born. That's the first take. The second part, that led to making some theory that was back then called phlogiston's theory obsolete. That theory postulated the existence of a fire-like element, dubbed phlogiston, contained within the combustible bodies and was released during combustion. There was another theory that was competing with the phlogiston theory called the caloric theory, which is also an obsolete scientific theory by now, and it stated that the heat consists of self-repellent fluid called caloric. And pretty much that flows from hotter bodies to colder bodies. So, you know, like, part of the theory is like now makes sense, right? But the whole piece about repellent fluid is the part that, you know, that got obsolete. But like, you can see now people are starting to grasp the physical meaning of heat, but it's still not there yet. So Antoine's proposed subtle fluid called caloric is a substance of heat. And according to his version of caloric theory, the quantity of the substance is constant throughout the universe, and it flows from warmer to colder bodies. So indeed, he was one of the first to use a calorimeter to measure the heat released during a chemical reaction. However, there was one critical showstopper for his theory. Since heat was a material substance in that theory, and therefore it can neither be created nor destroyed, so there was this concept of conservation of heat was the centerpiece in that theory, which, you know, it's like super close, but it's not the conservation of heat. We know that's going to be conservation of energy,
right?
So now we move to a very critical scientist and never gets the appreciation that she deserves, and that Émile du Châtelet. Émile was a French mathematician, physicist, and author, and played a gigantic critical role during the Age of Enlightenment. Émile's translation of Principia is regarded as her scientific achievement and is still the standard reference in French for Newtonian mechanics. She basically translated Isaac Newton's Principia into French and is still, to the modern day, the most well-known reference in French for that translation. Emily's work helped to make Newton's work more accessible and insightful, and she's considered a key figure in illuminating the Enlightenment through her writings. In 1737, she stated that the light was massless, an extraordinary, original, and a correct idea. She realized that light traveled extremely fast, and she reasoned that if it had mass, its impact on Earth would be devastating. Because, like, at that speed, imagine if you have mass, you're gonna have a very destructive power. She also measured the heat. I know, right? Like, and you never heard about that before. We never get to hear about that. And she was really brilliant scientist in all aspects, and she never got the, you know, the credit she deserves. Right. So that's why, like, I really want to give her a very critical appreciation for her part, you know, for the critical role she played,
right,
especially in thermodynamics. She also measured the heating caused by different colors of light. And she discovered that there was an invisible light that could warm a thermometer. And that's what we called later the infrared light.
That is so cool.
I know. It's really awesome. Like, you know, like, and you know, like, and so, you know, up till now, there was a persistent confusion about heat at that time, as we have mentioned. Whether it had a mass, how it was stored and liberated, where it went, and how light and flame related to heat.
Yeah.
So Emily, like, derived the principle of energy conservation from the fundamental principle of Newton's mechanics. So up to Newton, mechanics was pretty much about momentum. There was no energy yet. Momentum is proportional to velocity. But like, she was the one that added on, whereas kinetic energy now varies with the square of the velocity. So beside everything that was stated about her, now the kinetic energy in perspective, not defined as kinetic energy, but like, she pretty much like related that the energy of motion varies in, like, directly or
it's
proportionally with the square of velocity. The focus on that energy was central in the later development of mechanics by Lagrange, Hamilton, and others. So we just have to keep in perspective died at the age of 42. She just, like, because of unfortunately complication of birth, but just imagine the amount of predictions that she made in thermodynamics and beyond.
Right.
Within that era. And how, like, you know, how limited education for women were. Like, right. It was super insane how brilliant she is. Now, like, then, like, as, like, Thomas Young came along. And I, for our audience that might not know Thomas Young, Thomas was an English Egyptologist, physician, and physicist who established the principle of interference of light and hence resurrected the century-old wave theory of light. Also, Young worked on measuring the size of molecules, surface tension in liquids, and on elasticity. We already know him, like, pretty much from material science. His name is synonymous with Young's modulus. It's basically the constant that describes the relation between the stress and the strain of material. However, in his relation with thermodynamics, he is the first one to coin the term energy as an energy word and give it its like scientific significance. Now, moving to, like, you know, like, one of the most famous folks in thermodynamics, Nicolas Leonard Sadi Carnot. And he was a French mechanical engineer in the French army. He was a military scientist and a physicist, and he is often described as the father of the thermodynamics. In 1824, he published Reflections on the Motive Power of Fire, expressed as the first successful theory of a maximum efficiency of heat engines, and laid the foundations of the thermodynamics. The most important contribution Carnot made to thermodynamics was his abstraction of the essential features of the steam engine, as they were known in his day, into a more general and idealized heat engine. This resulted in a model thermodynamic system upon which exact calculation could be made and avoided the complications introduced by many of the crude features of the prior steam engines. He also showed the efficiency of an idealized engine is function of only two temperatures, which basically the reservoirs, the heat source and the heat sinks between which it operates. However, he did not give the exact form of that function. He was a believer in the caloric theory, though, where he stated, and why I'm quoting him there, that the motive power of heat is independent of the agents employed to realize it. Its quantity is fixed solely by the temperature of the bodies between which is affected. Finally, the transfer of caloric. So pretty much he concluded that the production of the motive of power is therefore due in steam engines, not to actual consumption of the caloric, but to its transportation from a warm body right. to a cold body.
Right.
A competing, pretty much like a scientist called Gaspard Gustave de Coriolis. He was a French mathematician. Unfortunately, this dude was actually also in the part of the French War, Revolutionary War, but he was on the king's side. Carnot was on Napoleon's side. So you know, like why Carnot is like well mentioned. Unfortunately, Coriolis, you know, never got also attention that he deserved because he was always like historically on the losing side. But he was a French mathematician, mechanical engineer, and a scientist. He's best known for his work on the supplementary forces that are detected in rotating frame of reference, and that's what we call today Coriolis effect.
That is insane.
I know. So I know, like it's that's why it was really critical. You can see how like everything, you know, being put together in a very logical manner to come to the conclusion how everything that we see in our textbook nowadays was basically based. I mean, there was no magic. Everything was logical. There right. was a lot of foundation. There was lots of layers built into it. So in 1829, Coriolis published his book, Calculation of the Effect of Machines. And he was the first to apply the term work for the transfer of energy by force acting through a distance. He was the first to prefix the factor half to the kinetic energy. So before him, kinetic energy was just mv squared. He was the first to basically get the mechanical work and define what work is and basically add the critical factor we have, which is the half part of, to the kinetic energy term, which is the accurate term for the kinetic energy, half mv squared. Now, after these guys comes like a dude that is very famous to all of us, Emile Clapeyron.
Yeah,
I know. So Emile Clapeyron was pretty much the most significant when we're talking about the thermodynamics. His most significant work was in 1834, where his first contribution was the creation of modern thermodynamics by publishing a report entitled Memoir on the Motive Power of Heat. He pretty much, in which he developed upon the work of Sadi Carnot. It was pretty much like, you know, building what Carnot unfortunately couldn't do, you know, because like he died pretty young as well, suffering at a younger age. So Emil, in his memoir, presented Carnot's work in a more accessible and analytical graphical form, showing the Carnot cycle as we know today, as a closed curve on an indicator diagram, basically a chart that relates pressure against volume. And that's basically what we have named Clapeyron's graph. In 1843, Clapeyron further developed the idea of a reversible process already suggested by Carnot and made a definitive statement of Carnot's principle. Then comes William Thomson and James Joule. William Thomson, which also known as Lord Kelvin, that's the dude that will later become like Lord Kelvin, was a British mathematician, mathematical physicist, and an engineer. By 1947, Thomson wasn't a fan of the caloric theory that we mentioned earlier, and while attending the British Association for the Advancement of Science annual meeting in Oxford, he heard James Joule making yet another of his so far ineffective attempts to discredit the caloric theory of heat. You know, the problem is James Joule back then, at this moment in time, He wasn't seen by the society yet as a physicist. He was literally a guy that has a brewery. And he always made an attempt to discredit the, you know, the caloric theory. He wasn't convinced of it. And he was against the fact that heat is not conserved. And he was arguing for the mutual convertibility of heat and mechanical work and their mechanical equivalents.
Right.
And that's pretty much what William Thompson came around and basically supported. He found this guy that pretty much, like, you know, finally spoke in his language, and he supported him in that sense. So in 1848, Lord Kelvin extended the Carnot-Clapeyron theory further through his dissatisfaction that the gas thermometer provided only an operational definition of temperature. He wasn't convinced of, like, you know, the fact that we have Celsius or Fahrenheit. There is nothing core physical there. So he proposed the absolute temperature scale, as we know nowadays as the Kelvin scale. In 1867, Kelvin co-authored a book called Treatise on Natural Philosophy. That was the first physics textbook where the term potential energy was introduced. Kelvin also calculated the amount of gravitational potential energy released during the sun's accretion, which he concluded was a source of sun's radiated energy. So, as we have seen so far, we have the concept of energy defined. Kinetic energy and potential energy, mechanical work rated to force over a distance. Then the concept of efficiency finally was born. All these elements that we always get to study till this day as we get introduced to thermodynamics, all originating from the steam engine, from turning heat into work during the Industrial Revolution, which was by default a closed system, which is why we have internal energy, not enthalpy, yet being a fundamental variable in the first law of thermodynamics as defined by Rudolf Emanuel Clausius. In 1865, Clausius published a paper that included his statements of the first and second laws of thermodynamics. He stated that the energy of the universe is constant, paving the way for the law of conservation of energy. That energy cannot be created nor destroyed, but it can be transformed from one form to another. Clausius based his understanding of this law on experimental evidence that was provided by James Joule. He also interpreted free heat as kinetic energy of particles in a body, and work done to increase this kinetic energy as an increase in temperature, which came along later on to be known as the internal energy.
Man,
and now,
bumps.
That's pretty much how all these elements came along. So pretty much that's the first form that we see, you know, around here. That's Clausius' first form that he put in his book. And it's basically the change of internal energy equates to the heat provided to that system minus the work, or, you know, it depends on how you define heat versus work, that you can extract from that system. That's pretty much the first law. Why it was a closed system? That's because everything during that era was based on the steam engine, and everything was in a piston. That's why, like, it was an internal energy versus heat and work. So that differential form for energy versus heat and work, we can neglect the difference in potential energy and kinetic energy. Pretty much the work can be split into the piston, which is basically pressure was like how that volume that you have in the system changes. And that's the PDV that comes along. So how the enthalpy came around? It came around if you combine the internal energy with the PDV form you get the enthalpy. And that's what the open system is, equivalent of the internal energy. And that's the enthalpy. So in order to transfer the singular, like the simplest form of the first law of thermodynamics is like based on heat, work, and internal energy. Now the whole thing can be generalized to be the rate of energy change of the system per unit time is basically the sum of all the heat into the system minus all the work done on the system. In addition to rate of enthalpy N, kinetic energy N, potential energy N versus the kinetic energy enthalpy and the kinetic energy out of that system. That's the general form. If you basically take an unsteady state system, you neglect the kinetic energy, potential energy, and state that that's a closed system, the only thing would be left is the rate of change of internal energy with time basically equates to the heat flow in minus the work flow, or basically the horsepower on that system. Now, if you multiply a rate of change of work per time, and the heat flow, you multiply by the time, you get basically the first law that we have. The change of U over a given period of time would be the heat minus the work. Now, we always like get around the exact versus the inexact differentials, or state versus a path property. So to just defining it in a physical term, an exact differential or imperfect differential is a differential whose integral is a path dependent. And that's what means a path function. So that's why, like, you know, when we learn, you know, in further explanation down for, you know, examples around the thermodynamics, we always have to be saying, when we want to be calculating a work around the compressor, we always have to be like saying, oh, that's isentropic, this is adiabatic, this is isothermal. Why? Because you have to implicitly define what path you are taking.
Right.
Work can have different pathways.
Right.
Why? Because, however, when you're talking about an exact differential or a total differential, like internal energy or enthalpy, that's a state function or a state property. Once you be like saying, I have a temperature pressure 1 versus temperature pressure 2, you already stated what enthalpy is at the final state versus the initial state. Now, how you go from 1 to 2, it will have infinite amount of solutions because it have so many combinations of heat and work.
Right.
Infinite combinations there. So what do we have, like when we have like two variables and one equation, basically that means you're going to have a different equation needs to be stated in order to be like having two equations, two variables to be having a defined system. And that's pretty much what second law is. Just, we're not talking about the second law today, but that's why the second law was necessary. We have infinite amount of solutions for Q and W, and we need another equation in order to define what is going to be the exact Q and what's going to be the exact W. So the first law as an enthalpy and internal energy came from, you have U, Q, and PdV, which is basically the work. When you split this out, you have the dQ minus BdV. I'll basically take the BdV with the dU, that's basically your enthalpy. But when you have a constant pretty much like pressure in this our system or a closed system, pretty much the VdV goes out. And the dH or enthalpy can break down into CVdT plus BdV plus VdV. As you can see, because dU is going to come later on to be a function of the specific energy at constant volume multiplied by the dT. Or if you go to like a completely closed system and you have like the DQ equals CVT from the calorimeter that we spoke about earlier, the DQ will be DU CVDT minus BDV. So based on the first law of thermodynamics, the CV is a specific heat that condenses volume, is a temperature dependent parameter. And pretty much internal energy enthalpy becomes exclusively state function of pressure, temperature, and volume. You have the dH function of dT, dV, dP. And on the other hand, you have the dU function of dT and dV. But are PTV are truly independent variables? So just we're going to have to be holding the thought for our next episode. So to summarize what we have talked about so far, Industrial Revolution and steam engine kicked off before the laws of thermodynamics were established. Newton's physics correlated the living force to momentum. The concept of energy conservation was established by Émile du Châtelet. Sadi Carnot formulated the maximum efficiency of a thermocycle. Lord Kelvin and Rudolf Clausius introduced the modern form of first law of thermodynamics. The first law of thermodynamics is pretty much the law of enthalpy and internal energy. State function is a path independent, while path function is path dependent. That's all we have about today's episode. I hope it was a very productive episode, and we're looking forward to be like seeing you our next episode coming up. So what do you think, Brandon?
So I just want to say thank you for joining us today. I realize that we're still kind of at that high level overview, but hopefully you can see kind of from the topics we talked about previously, such as propane dehydrogenation and synthesis of hydrogen. We're trying to kind of show you how you can take some of these simpler concepts, enthalpy, entropy, and tie them into things that we see in industry. Like, how do you make a propane process work? How do you synthesize hydrogen? How do you separate hydrogen? Things of that nature. So please do bear with us. If you do have any questions or comments, please send an email to sciencemadesimple@outlet.com. Leave a comment on our YouTube videos, or hey, on the podcast, follow us there, leave a comment, leave a review, let us know what you think. That's all I got. Signing off.